as Justice Armonis and going through Justice Murphy's notes on the conferences, that he has many long summaries of statements by most of the other justices, but rarely does he have more for you than a simple reverse or affirm, or occasionally a direct statement, perhaps a sentence or so. Do you think these notes would, in general, though not necessarily in a particular case, characterize your participation in conference?
Well, I think perhaps generally they would. Views that sometimes were stated at length, more often than not, however, they were stated in a more of a summary way. I never developed the habit, such as Frankfurter had, and to some extent Black and Stone had, of using the conference as a occasion to try to convince people to change their views or to line up behind my school of thought. I thought then and still think that in most instances the people who walk into the conference room have pretty well made up their minds, and I've seen very few conferences in which that have resulted in views being changed. Now at times it does happen. At times, a view of one judge will be changed. That's largely because he's fluid when he walks in on the fence. It can go either way, but most of the time, these men, they're mature men. They've studied the cases. When they came up in for the sifting process on the grant of certiorari or the noting of an appeal, and then they have listened to the arguments, they're strong-minded, and it seemed to me not to be generally useful to get into the long argumentation that some of my brethren engaged in. The most conspicuous examples, as I said, are Frankfurter, and probably after him Stone, and after Stone Black. They were all strong-minded judges. With a flair for speaking, and there's no reflection on them. It's neither demerits or merits. It's just a characterization. Most of the other judges that I've served with have been more succinct and brief in their statement of their views.
I was wondering, something you said reminded me of another thought I had when I was looking over Murphy's conference notes. I think we're all familiar with the fact that the Stone conferences got very involved, but I seem to notice that in the Vinson conferences, there was less of, at least in his notes, there was less interruption. For example, Vinson would state the case, then it seemed the discussion would simply go around the table rather than with Stone, where you would have Stone, then Roberts, then Black, then Frankfurter, then Roberts, this sort of thing that seemed to be more ordered. Does this comport with your memory?
Yes, of course, Vinson followed Stone, and by that time, members of the court were pretty well exhausted, as Stone was when he died, on these endless, interminable conferences. And I think that part of what you mentioned was a reflection that a better regime would be the less talk, shorter hours, less debate on unimportant, picayune-ish things. And I think that was generally the pattern that was established, and that has continued under Warren. Of course, under Hughes, you had something at the other extreme, a very quick summary statement of a conclusion with a very pithy short paragraph containing reasons, and then an end of the discussion in a rapid rotation around the table that irritated some of the justices, particularly Stone. But I think that the Hughes technique was probably in the long run most productive, because it's exposed all the important issues, let everyone have a chance to speak who wanted to speak, and then but didn't take up your time unnecessarily in endless, petty discussions of all points, little points, middle-sized points, and big points.
I have a somewhat different question next. From the various memoranda in Frank Murphy's papers, and as you can see from this, I spent part of the summer going through Frank Murphy's papers, I would guess that in his first few years on the court, that is Murphy's first few years, Frankfurt was quite influential with him. Then a gradual ideological estrangement developed. Is this, do you remember things going this way, or is this...
Yes, that's fairly accurate. I think that when Frank Murphy came on, he had not known Frankfurter. He respected him from a distance as a great liberal intellectual, as a great teacher, as a promoter of liberal causes such as the defense of Sacco Vanzetti. And when he came to the court, therefore, he naturally came under the strong influence of Frankfurter. He leaned to him, he looked up to him, he followed his votes very often in close cases when he was in doubt, because thinking that Frankfurter had the superior wisdom. And then Murphy had a gradual disillusionment because he realized that Frankfurter was not the man that he thought he was, although able, although bright, and although very resourceful, and although protesting that he never was—he was one judge who never wrote his own predilections into the law. That Frankfurter was probably the most subjective judge that Murphy had ever known. That was part of it. He became very distrustful of Frankfurter. He talked to me many times about it. Murphy did. Another part of it was Frankfurter went to great lengths to ridicule Murphy. Ridicule Murphy's scholarship, ridicule him in all of his work, making fun of things he would write. Sometimes ridiculing him in conference. And these personal insults got deep under Frank Murphy's skin. He talked to me many times about them. Frank Murphy was not the Harvard Law Review type of scholar that Frankfurter seemed to adore, but I suppose most of the Harvard Law Review type of scholars would make lousy judges, and Frankfurter gradually became, I think in Frank Murphy's eyes, the a very undesirable example, a man he did not trust any longer, a man who was full of all sorts of guile and tricks and deceitful statements in conferences, a man who say one thing to your face, another thing behind your back. And Murphy was an easy target because by professional standards, normal professional standards, he wasn't the man to be named here because he had been so far out of the law, so far removed from the law, so very little practice of teaching. He'd been in public life most of his career, and didn't have the same intellectual discipline that people harnessed to the plow in the law yet. Yet the experience of being harnessed is usually a very limiting experience. It's a makes one look down rather than up. And Frank Murphy, I thought, was eminently qualified, one of the best judges we've had in my 24, 25 years, because he had the temperament, and the scholarship is not unimportant, but the feeling about law and about justice, about people, about the weight of government coming against the individual, I think those are all very important. That's why I think Frank Murphy is a great contribution.
This also reminded me of something else. I was surprised when I went through the Frank Murphy papers to find what seemed to me in the notes to be a real personal coldness between Murphy and Black. I would have expected that since they voted together so often and joined in opinions, that the notes between each other would have been much more cordial, but there was a very chill tone to them.
I don't think there was any chill in the relationship between Black and Murphy. I think Frank Murphy had a great respect for Hugo Black. He knew that Black never was up to these petty Frankfurter devices, that he was honest, he was straightforward. He never made fun of Murphy. He was respected his integrity as an individual and his dignity as a human being. I don't think that they were socially very close. I don't think that they were had that common bond that builds for sociability, but they were very friendly at the professional level.
I would have gathered too from his papers that Murphy and Rutledge were very close professionally and personally.
They were very close. Murphy and Rutledge were very close. They had offices near each other, and they spent quite a lot of time together. And Murphy and I were very close. I haven't seen his papers, but I mean, apart from conferences and the hours at the law, we were very close in the off hours.
The next question concerns the famous doorbell ringing case of Martin versus Struthers in the 1942 term. And according to Justice Murphy's docket books and notes on the conference, Black first voted to affirm the conviction and actually circulated a majority opinion to that effect. Then, with no explanation that Murphy preserved, Black switched his vote and ended up writing an opinion for himself and the four justices, including you, who had dissented from his previous opinion. This new opinion, of course, held the ordinance unconstitutional. I wonder if you recall what might have happened between the circulation of these two opinions to change Justice Black's mind so completely.
Well, I think that's Murphy's account is an accurate historical account as to what happened, because it was a 5-4 decision with Jackson, Frankfurter, Reed, Black, and Roberts voting to affirm, and with Rutledge, Murphy, Stone, and myself voting to reverse. And as I remember, Black did circulate an opinion to affirm, and there were some lots of discussion about the case, and there were some separate opinions written. As I remember, Rutledge had one, and Murphy had one, and Black had circulated an opinion, as I remember, to affirm, and it got returns from many people, I don't know, maybe from four, so that he had a court opinion. And then, on further reflection, in a passage of time, he changed his vote and wrote his opinion in a separate way.
I was wondering whether your recollection then is that perhaps it was Rutledge who circulated a dissenting opinion.
I think it was Rutledge. opinion. A dissenting opinion. And I think that, I'm a little vague, but I think that Murphy perhaps sent around some kind of memorandum too. But this was, the matter of this was, of this Martin B. Struthers was very much mooted here in the building. We had luncheon talks about it and whatnot. And Black, who usually stays put, pulled out and from that majority and made the became the head of the new majority. That is not unusual, except in this respect, it's in the 24 odd years I've been here, a man who is doubtful at conference, and he is the ninth man, which if he goes one way will be reversed and another way to affirm, is usually assigned the opinion to write quite wisely. After getting it, he may have indicated at a conference that he would vote to affirm with reservations, and gets it and studies it and writes to reverse, but it's very exceptional to have a judge who was in doubt take the case, write it one way, and then, after further reflection, withdraw that opinion and write it the other way.
Yes,
and but that did happen in the Martin Struthers.
Well, there's also a related question here. According to Justice Murphy's docket book, in Adamson versus California in the 1946 term, Justice Black at first passed at the conference. Later, of course, he wrote one of the more famous dissents in recent court history. Most scholars have assumed that Frankfurter's opinion in this case was written to answer Black. Yet Black's pass makes it seem equally likely that his opinion was written to answer Frankfurter. I wonder if you recall which opinion was circulated first.
Well, I can't recall. You're quite accurate that at the conference, when the case was first voted on, that Black did not vote. He expressed himself as doubtful. He was, I think at that time, worried about the Fourth Amendment as well as the Fifth Amendment. Black has had somewhat of a restrictive view, what I would call a restrictive view on the Fourth Amendment, perhaps due to his background and experience in that field, where he was in the Senate investigating lobbying, and he was in the courts on his legality of his own subpoenas that his committee had issued. All that's well known history. But whether that changed his views, whether his views at all were already more on the side of the prosecutor than on the side of the accused as a result of his role as a prosecutor in Alabama, no one knows. I never talked to him about it. Perhaps he doesn't know or wouldn't know. But at this original conference on Adamson, I think his thinking about the Fifth Amendment being applicable was tied up to the possibility of the Fourth. And in retrospect, it's interesting to speculate because for a while he thought that while the Fourth was applicable to the states, the exclusionary rule of the Weeks case that our court had fashioned for federal prosecutions was not applicable to the states by reason of the incorporation of the Blackmore of concurring opinion, Murphy. Murphy dissented,
yes.
He had dissented earlier, I know. I wrote a dissent because the only practical sanction of any value for an unlawful search and seizure is the unavailability of the seized evidence for use in the criminal prosecution. Well, I'm not sure that I'm exactly wholly accurate of all doubts blacks that they were somehow tied up with the evidentiary rule that seemed to be emerging from the Adamson case and the relationship of that to the same problem under the fourth. So he passed, and he was doubtful at the conference, and I think that his opinion finally gelled after Frankfurter had circulated. So I think that the Frankfurter, as I remember, had extensive revisions, but Black certainly was not out in front circulating a memorandum to the conference in advance of the court opinion, because he wasn't prepared to do that at that time.
This is what it seemed to me through going through the papers.
Yeah.
I'm just not at all sure. Do you recall, or do your papers show, how Justice Murphy originally voted in the milk wagon driver's case of the 1940 term? I ask because Murphy's papers indicate that he was pretty much on the fence, that his law clerk suggested to him that he not write a separate opinion, but he wait to see Black's and Frankfurter's and then choose between them, and since his vote would be crucial, to get whomever he sided with to change his opinion to go along with the lines of his projected concurring opinion.
Well, I don't think that's quite accurate. At the conference, as my notes show, Murphy didn't vote, he passed. However, my conference notes were compiled after the conference, because this conference, I think I missed them. But the vote at the conference was 5 to affirm, with Frankfurter, Roberts, Stone, McReynolds, and Hughes. There were 3 to reverse. I think I'd left my votes with Black, myself, Reed, and Black, with Murphy passing. And then the file shows, as the opinions began to be circulated, Murphy having questions and doubts about Black's dissent. I think in one place he said that he had, in a note to Black, said that he had a page full of questions and so on about the dissent. I don't have too clear recollection as to what was bothering him. I think it was probably the background of the horrible experience of the sit-down strike that he went through in Detroit, and the emergence of force and violence and the fear of that getting loose in the community. That's just speculation on my part, but those were the kind of things that were worrying him vis-a-vis Black's draft dissent. But he wasn't the swing man, no. The critical man. His vote was not material to the outcome.
According to Justice Murphy's docket book, the conference vote on Aikens versus Texas in the 1944 term was 5-4 to reverse. The decision came down 6-3 to affirm, with you and Justice Roberts having changed sides. Do you recall what led you, at least, to change your mind?
I'm sorry, I don't at this time recall. Perhaps if I go further into my files, I can get some clues to it, but I have no present recollection.
Fine. Well, the next question is somewhat similar and concerns two cases, Kermiel versus Chicago in the 1948 term and Thomas versus Collins in the 1944 term, in which you first voted to affirm and later changed your mind. In the first case, you ended up writing the majority opinion, and the latter a concurring opinion. I wonder again if in these instances you might have any recollection of what led to your change.
majority to affirm, and the opinion was assigned to me to write, perhaps because I'd expressed some doubts. The reason that I voted to affirm and then changed my mind was on the question of whether the question was properly, had been properly raised, properly presented. And at the conference, I didn't see how we could reach it. When I studied the case, I concluded that we could, for the reasons that I stated in the opinion. My records do not show any change in my vote. My records show that at the conference I voted to reverse along with Rutledge, Jackson, Murphy, and Black. Those voting to affirm at that conference being Frankfurter, Reed, Roberts, and Stone. There were a lot of us, of course, a number of us had doubts and perplexities about the case, the line between making the speech and using your office as a union leader to get funds out of members, the that nebulous line between solicitation and speech. But and I may have at the conference expressed some of those doubts, but my records show that I didn't change that. I voted on the side of reversal right from the start.
It would certainly be more consistent with your, this is the reason I asked the question, be more consistent with your views as you stated them before that case and after that case to vote to reverse and on the way through.